got water and cups too, so.
I've never heard the Gatorade story. That's great.
I know, it was very nice.
We've got our esteemed panel up here, and I think we've had a very interesting and long
One down here.
This is an opportunity for everybody to go into the detail and ask the panel any additional questions that you have, and perhaps we can even foster some cross-panel discussions.
Yeah, the only request I have is this is the mic that has the recording. So questions come, if we might be able to repeat the question in here or something, that might work out well for the recording.
Any questions from the floor?
I've got some questions. I'd like to get a perspective, maybe from Joan, with the relationships that you, and then I'll ask Danielle Sue the same question. With the relationships that you've had with the university environment, or even other cooperative relationships where they have went positive, what were the attributes there that made those types of interactions successful? And when they went negative, what were the attributes that allowed that not to work out? And then Danielle Sue, from your perspective and your collaborations with your other co-development partners, really what made it work in those successful instances, and what made it fall apart, and how are those things addressed?
Okay, I guess one caveat is that we're probably still moving toward a phase of having these, you know, more robust agreements with particular universities. So I'm not sure if there's a whole lot of examples to draw from. But I think that, you know, I mean, generally, I think it's a matter of understanding what is motivating the university's positions. And, you know, some of these presentations really were helpful, I think, in terms of you know, understanding some of the, you know, the formula with NIH, and you know, it's not just there is an impression, I think, in industry that that university administrators are lining their pockets or something. You know, I mean, I'm being facetious, of course, but there is sort of this sense that it's sort of an arbitrary number of what overhead costs are. You know, what that percentage is, because it does vary from university to university. And so sometimes if you don't have visibility as to what is what drives those decisions, I think that can create a lot of just general misunderstanding and mistrust. I think the other thing that, you know, it's interesting, you know, you being from Dow asking the question, I'm also I have to point out that I think one issue that we have in trying to be open with universities is that we're also aware that the universities are working with our competitors. And so we want to be obviously careful about what kind of information we share and in what context. And, you know, and to what degree universities either purposely or not may be sharing that information with people that it would not be appropriate to share. So I guess I'm not really answering the question directly, but it's just, I think it's a whole host of sort of understanding motivations and making sure that interests are aligned.
Yeah, so the question is, what is make it successful, what is make it fail? Well, let me give you an example of CenterCon. Initially, when we were developing this thing, I tell you, we're very open. Between me and Dow researcher, we are totally open to each other. We did not think we have to hide anything, but we also are very aware of that the openness within our group has to be compartmentalized. don't meet within the group. We don't just go and share with third party or somebody who's not within that group. And that is a very important thing. We always realize that if I'm sharing something you guys don't have, you share with me, I'm not one to talk to the other company. And this thing has to be totally put in the compartment all of them. And that is probably one thing that we need to do. Things started really getting real difficult in recent years with any industry researchers. I think it's because of regulation and legal issue. When I started seeing more lawyers' involvement within the agreement, and that thing started, I don't point a finger to anything, but when lawyers started stepping in and say, oh no, maybe you should not do this, maybe you should not do that. Now, when one party started to close up because they want to protect themselves, everybody started to withdraw into their own shell, and things started falling apart. And that is really the big thing I've seen in recent years, when things start kind of doesn't go anywhere, because while one party lawyer decided that they'll be more protective and try to defend themselves, try to secure their own rights. But if you do that, everybody looking at each party and say, if you do that, I do that too. And everybody withdraw into their own shell, nobody talk to each other anymore, and that nobody develop anything. That is really one of the unfortunate things I'm seeing in recent years.
I just have to say, working with the industry, that we have a protocol ready to go. We're going to go out in the field with it and visit with you folks, and our legal department comes back and says, your confidentiality agreement, it just makes you cringe. This is going to be a tough road a whole lot of times. So, question I had, it came with Dr. Foster's presentation earlier, and it was just kind of there, and then went by it, but it was this product recommendation statement. And deal with a lot of universities, and there's times where, you know, you get a series of product recommendations based upon yield or quality or something of this nature. But then you go to other universities, and the statement is, we will not recommend a single product. No way, we're not going to go, you know, we're not going to, for whatever legal reason might be. Just some comments on that and how to deal with some of those interactions.
Sure, we've taken the approach that, say, in the pesticide area, that we recommend things based on our personal knowledge or knowledge from the literature, insecticide and herbicide reports, those sort of places, or just communication with other specialists. One of the things we don't do is list everything with labeled, because we don't think that's a recommendation, that's just a list. And so we want some personal knowledge of some sort that the product's going to work the way it for the uses we recommended for. And that's kind of how we establish that. Any other question?
Yeah, just
okay.
It's a wide open area.
Yeah. But you know, it's a challenge. You know, we wrestle with the idea. Well, do we rank these things, or how do we tell people what's the best? And generally, we either say they work or they don't work, and kind of let the customer decide which one's best. On a one-on-one basis, if a client calls me up and says which one we can use, I'll give my opinion. But in a print form or whatever, we don't tend to do that.
If I may add to that, Bob, in response to your question, the laws, you know, vary from state to state. In some states, you know, our faculty can go ahead and make recommendations. Other states, you can't do it. So that's part of the problem we have as well.
I found it quite interesting, the different ways of bringing things to market from the perspective of the industry or from the university side. And what was interesting was the difference between trademarking, licensing, and IP, and the implications in each of those different types of angles. Now, from an industry perspective, is it better to have IP and only
trademark. And then I think what you were trying to, or what you were getting at is it better to own a patent or to have a license to a patent or an exclusive license to a patent? In effect, I guess an exclusive license to a patent is gives you much of the rights that ownership would, but ownership, of course, is probably the preferred position, and you know, usually any sort of license could have limitations that are something less than full ownership. But I think, you know, there are a lot of situations where having a license is good enough for commercialization purposes, and obviously there are reasons why the university need to maintain title and ownership. So I think that luckily we're in a situation where everybody's needs could probably be met. I hope that helped.
So let me answer that from the university's perspective, and this is probably true for most universities in America, is more and more, particularly in relation to master agreements and things like that, we're coming up with co-owning IP. We're looking at ways where industries and universities can co-own it, so then you go through the whole process of patenting it together. Also, we have clauses in there that we give the first right of refusal as it were. Okay, so the company might make a decision to look at it, see if they do their due diligence and determine, no, we don't want to patent it. Or then the university has the right to look at it too. So we work together very closely to make sure that the intellectual property that results from the work that's been undertaken has an opportunity to see the light of day, and that it might be called under a patent individually away. In terms of, and so you play it by ear, each one is different. You cannot apply this rule to every endeavor that you're involved in. In terms of licensing, obviously for universities, we want to reserve the rights if it's our IP. If it's co-owned, then you have a very different set of rules that come to play. If it's the university's IP, then we don't want to give exclusive license to a company, in part because we might want to go flog it with other companies as well. For example, Purdue University, we have a yeast that ferments both 6 carbon sugars and 5 carbon sugars concurrently. So from a cellulose ethanol, it's the hot item. And we've given non-exclusives to DuPont, to Iogen, to ADM, multiple companies, and we charge a pretty significant chunk of change for doing that. Alternatively, on other IP, we've given, if a company says, okay, we'll give you $10 million or whatever, some huge sum of money, then we would, you know, reserve the right to make that exclusive. So really, the offices of technology licensing and things like that, the universities have, they try to play, you know, they do due diligence, make sure that they're protecting the interests of the taxpayers. But the comment made that by Dr. Sue that, well, really, you know, 99% of the IP that's generated in universities doesn't see the light of day, but it's absolutely true. Very little light becomes out. And so we're coming up with new approaches to doing this as well, is that we get a sum of money up front, and then have a Gatorade clause and things like that. I hope I answered your question.
Just one more comment. The Gatorade story I think is fascinating on many levels. But one area that I think deserves to be highlighted is that, you know, the universities are not in the business usually of licensing trademarks. And maybe that's a new area for universities to explore, because obviously, you know, trademarks have a great deal of value. You look at, just look at your beverages, Coca-Cola and Starbucks and whatnot. It's not, I think we've been, you know, sort of narrowly focused on patents based off scientific inventions.
Hi, I just want to try to bring up some of the other interactions that we need from the universities with the companies. And it's the fact that we're not having enough field of life entomologists. And the same is true for breeding. We don't have enough readers who actually are doing building instead of running with VCRs. And even though it's necessary to have the knowledge in the background, we also need the industry to feel like people and to be with science and technology. So I really like the presentation today, and I just want to bring it up so the professors as well as the students are aware that having experience in the field is necessary to work in partnership with the industry.
So I might go ahead and respond to that. And coming to the issue of plant breeding as well as applied agronomy or field-oriented individuals, you know. In America, what's happened is that about 30 years ago or so, universities realized that industry was much better equipped to deal with, you know, breeding crops and things like that. And so they started eliminating breeding programs in universities. And now 30 years later, what's happened is many of the breeders that were hired by industry are starting to retire and leave. And I know that the various American industries have said to me that there's a need for about 300 breeders just in America alone. And we're not equipped to be able to train those individuals because we don't have research programs in most universities. So we're all resurrecting our breeding research programs. But in order to train students, you got to have a breeding research program. And we've gotten into relationships with Dow AgroSciences, with Pioneer, with Monsanto, and others that are investing money in universities to create fellowships and things like that. It's going to take that sort of an investment. And that's true as well in the more applied area as well. So if you look at grant funds that our faculty go for from the federal agencies provide funding for the more sexy type of projects, you know. And so people have sort of migrated to doing the more molecular biology and things like that, when the sort of meat and potatoes applied type endeavors have taken a hit. And again, you know, like we've done with the breeding efforts, it'll take that sort of a partnership approach between the university and the industry to help facilitate more of these young people to be trained as well.
Yes, I'd like to direct this to Dr. Sue. You've been involved in a long process, a project that has revolutionized at least one area of pest management. Do you find after dozens of studies that you are now invested in the success of that particular product? And does that in some way set up a potential to impinge on your objectivity as an academic?
I didn't quite hear your first part of the question, but did my involvement with Centricon somehow interfere with my objectivity of my research?
Yes, when you find yourself working with a large company who has a marketing department and they're pushing one way, how does that work?
Well, if you believe in what you invented, what you come up with, it's good for the public. I have no shame to promoting it. If that is called bias, so be it. Everybody's biased for their own research to a certain extent. As far as the being objectively judged what is good and bad, I don't think so. I don't think I can abandon something like that. It's, you know, you can ask any of my students right now, but we don't do anything applied research right now, anyway. And I would never, the first thing, almost sitting here actually, you can ask them, but you know, the last thing I wanted to do is to compromise the scientific integrity. That is the thing we have, that is the thing we need to maintain. That's why I'm saying is you have to make a compartment for yourself. If you work with a company, you are honest with them, you trust them, each other, but you never, betray the trust. You know, integrity comes both ways, a double-edged sword. That's because I'm loyal to one company does not mean that I'm disloyal to the other. It's a different story.
Thank you.
Well, I'd like to look at that from another perspective. I'm a CRO, but I come from industry. And in the last 10 years, these agreements have evolved tremendously. They're not just disclosure agreements anymore. job is to make that protocol work in the field, deal with all the efficiency. But if you look at those agreements, and let me take an example, for example, if it was Syngenta, and in the process, then I had to come up with a way to do this. Those agreements are actually broad enough that to me the legal department would come in and say, that's ours, that technology, how to do that project, especially if that technique accelerated the process. And tomorrow Dow comes in with a similar project and we work with everybody. Hmm. Is that my technique? You know, that's to me that's our intellectual property that we're developing in order to execute the contract.
I'll just comment on that in the sense that I understand your point, and that actually has come up in other contexts as well, where you know we bring in a consultant or you bring in any kind of service provider that has their own proprietary methods and systems and software, or, you know, maybe something else altogether too. Usually the case is that we will try to clarify ahead of time what you consider to be pre-existing intellectual property of yours. And I think usually there's a way to work through that. On the other hand, you know, there are circumstances where I'm sure, you know, you can find, certainly if it hasn't been developed yet and it's developed on Syngenta's dime, so to speak, you know, there's going to be an argument that, yes, indeed, we should be entitled to whatever the innovation was. So, anyway, I guess it's sort of a case-by-case situation, but it's not one that can't be managed, I think.
Well, therein lies the problem. Where is that line? I mean, who develops the technique, especially within technology? The technique is based on the 4 years of doing it. So, to identify how to do it in advance, mm-hmm. really is impossible. That's why the companies come to us and work.
Right.
However, if we develop the technique to execute the contract, then the bad data is in general technique.
I guess, you know, we'd have to, again, without specifics, it's hard to say, make broad generalizations, but I would say that, you know, it's possible that you could decide that, you know, what we're interested in a particular output, and it may not be related to the technique of how you did it. And if that's the case, then it may be the case that we can agree ahead of time that any innovations that you develop in terms of how you got there, you know, we could acknowledge would be yours. But again, it's a little bit hard to say absent particular facts.
It's a very gray area. It's, you know, those contracts are written, those agreements are written in such a way, and we're dealing with individual agreements. A lot of times it's for individual, everyone for a different company. And of course, they're intentionally vague. That's what the legal profession does. And
it's really
difficult when you have that gray area, because after the fact come in and try to not have to decide where the line is.
Right. And I mean, it may be the case where, you know, this is everybody has to obviously come in and negotiate their position. And excuse me, if it is the case that Syngenta or Dow or anybody else going to say, you know, no, we're going to demand the IP, that, you know, you've got excuse me, I'd hate to kind of coach you to negotiate against me, but excuse me. But of course, you know, it may demand a situation where you might ask for increased fees or...
Well, getting to the end of the program today, I know I think Mr. Tolley has a few words to say yet, or... And then we'll close it off but when we're all done, certainly we want to give a big round of applause for the presenters today. But Mike, go ahead.
I just want to close. It's been a long 4 hours. It's 5:30. And I believe they're over starting the session to garner out the awards right now. So I want to wrap it up. I want to thank everyone for being here. I think we had a very interesting symposium. I want to remind you of our symposium for next year, and then we'll be in touch with you. And I want to give all of our presenters heartfelt thanks for being here with us and sharing the information.
you. Thank you, sir. That's very helpful. I've worked with a couple of IOs this year. I think it's a newsletter, too.
Well, you know, we keep waiting for the next one.
Yes, yeah, right here, it's getting close to the thing on here.
That would be fantastic. I'd really like to do some work.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.